All right, so we're in Deuteronomy. All right, we have about like a minute per chapter, so we could do this. So it's all good. We could do it. All right, so introduction to Deuteronomy, title of the book, just like some of the other ones. We get kind of our English title, Deuteronomy, from the Latin Vulgate, which is comes from like the Greek, which is like Deuteronoma. Oh my goodness, I can't do this on the spot. Deuteronomion. All right, that's probably terrible pronunciation, but it's something. So literally means the second law, okay, is kind of the idea here, right? Literally means the second law, but Deuteronomy is like not actually like a second law, okay, but rather it's kind of like an exposition of the Mosaic law that they received while at Mount Sinai, okay? So it's kind of building off of the Mosaic law here that we saw in Exodus. The Hebrew title is Ela Hadeberim, which means these are the words. And that again comes from like the first kind of chunk of words here at the beginning of Deuteronomy in the Hebrew text. And again, this sets the stage for this book because really it is almost kind of like a sermon that Moses is giving, explaining kind of the full theology of law to the nation of Israel. Okay, that's really what's happening here. Theme of the book, kind of one that's thrown out there a lot, kind of a common one, which is simple, makes sense, is the God who renews his covenant with Israel. So the God who renews his covenant with Israel. And that captures the basic idea, as we mentioned before, like Moses is explaining the law to this new generation and preparing them to enter into the promised land. And so you essentially have a sort of covenant renewal happening here. But another theme that I kind of like that goes in here that you'll see kind of emphasized throughout is the God who desires the heart. Okay, the God who desires the heart. And if you read through Deuteronomy, there's really an emphasis on God's concern for our heart or their heart. And I think we often think of that concern of God as like, oh, that's like New Testament. That like the Old Testament, he didn't really care about their heart. It's just works, whatever. But the New Testament, now God suddenly cares about people's heart. But what we see from Deuteronomy is that's not the case, right? That God has always been concerned of people's hearts. And so we'll see that emphasized throughout this book. All right, and the structure of the book. So the structure of Deuteronomy has been kind of linked with the structure of kind of different treaties of that time. And so more specifically, people have seen kind of a connection between the structure of Deuteronomy to the structure of Hittite suzerain vassal treaties. And so these were treaties made between like a conquering ruler, the suzerain, and the conquered people or rulers, the vassal. And so these treaties date back to kind of the conservative date that we proposed from the time of Moses, giving further support. Deuteronomy was written then rather than later during the reign of King Josiah. But again, we have to keep in mind that even though the structures are kind of similar and there's kind of this idea here, Deuteronomy is much more than just kind of a suzerain vassal kind of treaty here, right? It is really Moses' farewell address in the form of a sermon. And it's really expounding upon the law and its theology. And so even though there's some similarity in the structure, it is overall different though. And you have on your handout there, I believe, kind of the, you can see those similarities between this suzerain vassal treaty and what was normally composed of those. And then you have on the other side, kind of the structure of Deuteronomy that says, right? And so kind of this idea. And then below that, you have kind of a general outline that will follow as well, okay? All right, and so then into Deuteronomy itself. And so first few verses are the preamble, where this just kind of sets the stage for the Sermon on the Law by Moses. And so they have endured 40 years in the wilderness, where they have seen God's refining of the nation, and now they're looking forward to entering into the Promised Land. You have then, in the next kind of few chapters here, the historical prologue, which starts out looking to the past. So Moses kind of recounting all that has happened since they've received the law from the Lord on Mount Sinai. So kind of reviewing all that with this new generation, what they've witnessed and all that. And then he starts to look to the future in chapter 4, where he begins to lay out for Israel, if you listen and obey the law that is being set before them, then they will impact the nations just as they were always supposed to. But then there's also the warning of if they don't obey the law, then there's the resulting punishments of exile and being removed from the land. Okay? And so there's, again, this warning to the nation, like, hey, if you do this, right, you are going to be that light to the nations as you're called to be. But if not, right, then there's still exile and judgment as well. All right. And then this next section, again, kind of you're keeping the structure here, these general stipulations of the covenant for these next handful of chapters here. And again, like some will be like a little bit of repeat we've seen with Exodus. So we'll move a little quicker through this. And so we have these more general kind of requirements here. And so it makes sense that he then starts with the Ten Commandments. So chapter 5 starts out these general stipulations with the Ten Commandments themselves. And that makes sense because as we described the Ten Commandments before, they are essentially kind of like a summary of the law. You can say they summarize all the aspects and all the various like more specific laws are kind of like an outflow of those Ten Commandments. And so these are the general Ten Commands of the law. And then chapter 6 is very interesting. And this is where we start getting into this theme of God desiring the heart, where we see this kind of on display. Where in chapter 6, we see the heart of the law in this chapter. And this is contains in these verses 4 through 5 are some very important verses. We see they include kind of what Israel calls the Shema, which is like the Hebrew word for hear. And you see that like hear, O Israel, at the beginning of chapter 4. That's what that term Shema is. So very important verses here that really, again, get the heart behind the law. Okay. And so notice verse 4, it says, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. And again, this is a very important theological truth for Israel. And really, you could even translate this like Yahweh our God is one Yahweh. Okay, that's another way to translate this. And really, the emphasis of that is that Yahweh is one and doesn't share his glory with anybody else. Okay, he is the one, unique, and only God, and there is no one like him. Okay, we even talked about this like in Exodus. He is completely other. There is no other like him. Okay? But then the question kind of becomes, well, how do you then show or live out this absolute uniqueness of God? Okay, how do we respond to that? How do you show this or live that out? And you have the answer to that in verse 5. Is what? You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might. And so you love him and him alone. Because in doing so, you show that he is the only unique one and all your affections go to him and no other. That's what it is. That's the nature of loving God, because he is the exclusive, unique, only God and there is no one like him. All your love and affections go to him. Okay, does that make sense? That's the only response, right, to the uniqueness of God. And then the following verses of chapter 6 then to seem to kind of like give a picture of them. What does that look like kind of in everyday life? So verse 6, that involves putting his word on your heart. Verse 7 involves teaching God's word to your children. Verses 8 and 9, God's word is everywhere kind of around you. Verses 10 through 15, we see this involves not forgetting the Lord, okay? There's no apathy. True love does not forget. Verses 16 through 19, true love also doesn't test the Lord. We talked about that before of when people like test God, they're putting themselves in the authority over God, and so that is not loving him. And then even kind of wraps up verses 20 to 25. And true love of the Lord involves teaching future generations why they should love the Lord. And so, again, we see all this emphasized, right? That this is the heart of the law. It isn't like a matter of just strict external actions. It's also rooted in a love for God. Okay, and that's going to impact how you live. It's a matter of the heart. Essentially, okay? This has always been God's concern. All right, chapter 7. We see Israel is a holy people to the Lord, and they need to live like it as they enter the land. They need to live like it. And so they are to kind of devote to destruction the people that the Lord has determined. They're not supposed to intermarry with the pagans of the land, lest the people kind of turn them away from the Lord. And essentially the idea here is they show their love for the Lord by hating the things that he hates. Okay, so you're going to love the things he loves, but you're also going to hate the things he hates. Okay, that's part of this loving the Lord. Chapter 8 then goes into not being proud. So when they enter the land, they are not supposed to forget the Lord and think they accomplished this in their own strength. They are not supposed to be proud in this way. And notice chapter 8, verse 14. How does he describe this pride? How does he describe that pride? Yeah, your heart being lifted up. So again, we see the emphasis on the what? The heart. So don't let your heart be lifted up in that pride. Okay, but rather recognize that it was all the Lord's doing and give him the rightful worship he is due. Chapter 9. So not only is it supposed to not be proud, they're not to be self-righteous. Okay. When they come into the land, verse 4 says, what? Do not say in your heart. So again, emphasis on the heart. That it was because of their righteousness that the Lord brought them into the land to possess. Essentially, like to claim that is that God essentially kind of owed it to them. Because we are so righteous, God gave us this land. Which again, we have a new generation, but again, the previous generation and all that, like, definitely did not, God did not owe them anything, right? Kind of a thing. Okay, they were not righteous. So don't be self-righteous. And then chapter 10, we have kind of this call to circumcise your heart. So this is kind of an important part here. We're in verse 12 of chapter 10. Let's see. It says, "And now, Israel, what does the Lord your God require of you but to fear the Lord your God, to walk in all his ways, to love him, to serve the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul." So notice that, right? It kind of sums this all up, like to fear God, walk in his ways, love him with all your heart and soul. That's what it all comes down to. That's what's important. But then notice a little bit later in verse 16, because the reality is, though, even though this is like kind of that simple truth, what? They're sinful people, all right? They are sinful people. And so that's why you have in verse 16 this call, where it says what? To circumcise, therefore, the foreskin of your heart and be no longer stubborn. Okay, the Lord tells them you need to stop being stubborn, stop being stiff-necked, and instead circumcise your heart. And again, God's concern is for what? The heart here. Okay? And so they need to deal with their heart in order to live in a way that honors God. And we'll come back to that. Keep that in mind. So chapter 11, love and serve the Lord in the land. And so Moses lays out the reality, which he'll expand upon later, that if they're faithful to love the Lord and to serve him, keeping his commandments, they will be blessed. But then also if they rebel and disobey, they will also be cursed. And so they need to be careful to obey. And we'll see that emphasized later on as well. All right. All right, and then point number 4 there, we then have specific stipulations of the covenant. So we get into more kind of specific laws of how Israel ought to live when they're in land. And again, like I mentioned before, these are essentially just expounding the Ten Commandments, where you have those general commands, and then, okay, what's that look like in everyday life? What does that look like in certain situations or circumstances? And that's what you have unpacked here, okay? And so, again, we're not going to go through each one. Don't have the time for that. But I'll just kind of breeze through a lot of these and then kind of dive deeper into certain ones, okay, as we kind of go through. All right. So first one here is you'll have one place of worship. And again, you could see that, again, example connected with the Ten Commandments, right, where if you have a God that's to be above all else, to worship him and him alone, makes sense there is one place of worship. Okay, then he gives some warnings against idolatry, going after other gods. Then we have clean and unclean food, which again we talked about with Leviticus. We emphasize that a little bit more of what that meant, the kind of clean and unclean reality of all that. Talks about tithing, so giving to the Lord and all that. We have the sabbatical year mentioned again. We briefly touched on that. Not very much in Leviticus. And then we have in chapter 16, the annual feasts, which this again emphasizes kind of those three main feasts we talked about last time in Leviticus, Passover, the Feast of Weeks, which is Pentecost, and the Feast of Booths. And we talked about last week how each of those tied into their past, their present, and their future, okay? And all that. That's on the website if you want to remind yourself of that. And then chapter 16 and 17, we see laws concerning judges and other officials. And what you start to see here in this section is kind of various laws given to the leadership of Israel. And so we start by having some laws for the judges and other kind of officials. But then also the last part of chapter 17 is laws concerning kings. And so this is where we'll camp for a moment here. We see here some laws of that are supposed to affect the kings of Israel. So again, we knew that there is a plan for a king to come. And the first part really focuses on what the kings are kind of not supposed to accumulate. Okay, not supposed to accumulate. And so I had a professor in college, they kind of said this, and it's always kind of stuck with me, is you have the three G's of what they're not supposed to accumulate. So they're not supposed to accumulate gold, not supposed to accumulate gallons, and they're not supposed to accumulate Gideon. All right. So essentially, they're not supposed to accumulate gold, right? Like silver, gold, all that. They're not supposed to accumulate, multiply wives. That's the gals. And not supposed to multiply horses. That's the giddy up. Okay. So all that. But it's helpful. The three G's, right? It helps. Sticks in your mind. It's there. And so, again, you can kind of ask this question of, well, like, why? Why is this? Why is that a thing? Why does he bring up these three specific items? Because the reason for this is the accumulation of each of these things is essentially provides an avenue for a king not to trust the Lord. Okay? To not trust in the Lord. So when you have an excess amount of money, gold, what? You can buy whatever you need. You can buy whatever you want, and you might feel like you don't really need to trust the Lord. Okay? The gals, when you multiply wives on a foundational level, goes against kind of Genesis with the wife and the man becoming one, right? The two becoming one, kind of goes against that. But then also, normally during that time, what? You would make kind of marriage alliances, okay? Where people would marry someone from a royal family of another nation as a sign of an alliance, okay? We are now allies. And so as you do that, then what? You will be tempted to trust in those nations to help and support you rather than the Lord. Okay? So that's another reason why the multiplying the wives is bad. And then the last one, I'm sure you make sense when it talks about horses. It's not just like, if you really like horses, you can't have horses, right? But it's military, right? It's military is kind of the idea. So the accumulation of horses in the sense of a military, if you have a really strong military, then what? You're tempted to rely and trust in your military prowess, your military strength, rather than the Lord. Okay? So he gives these three things that you're supposed to avoid, these three things, the gold, the gals, the giddy-up, because what? They all threaten or provide an avenue for a king not to trust in the Lord, but rather in their own strength, in their own abilities or other things. Okay? And then something else of note that's kind of interesting in verse 18, it also talks about, says there, and when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, he shall write for himself in a book a copy of this law approved by the Levitical priests. And so it's interesting that not only is the king, they're not supposed to do these certain things, but also they're supposed to write their own copy of this law, probably like in reference to like the book of Deuteronomy. All right, so they're supposed to write their own copy of the book of Deuteronomy as a means to remind themselves of what the Lord has called them to, what they are to do and not to do, all that to be this leader of the nation. And what we see like throughout Israel's history, do they kind of keep up with that? No, right? Because what happens in like the reign of Josiah? You have someone find, like, we found the book of the law, like, they lost it, right? Like, so obviously not making copies to the point where they even, like, lost it for a while, and then they find them, like, oh, we're not doing what we're supposed to be doing, right? Like, we got to make some changes. And so that explains also some of the wickedness that happens during that time where the kings have departed from the law. All right, yeah.
How do we think about this versus like 1 Samuel 8 when it's like when they are asking for a king, it's almost seen there as like a wickedness of like not what is saying, like God saying, they're not rejecting you, Samuel, they're also rejecting me as their king. Versus like this sounding like, hey, it's okay to have a king.
Yeah, I think for me, I've understood it as like the plan was always to have a king, but the right king, right? Like we've seen this call of like there's a Messiah to come who will be from the line of Judah, who will be the king, who will lead and reign. But I think they wanted, like they said, like we want one just like the other nations, right? Like we want a king like the other nations, not your king, right? Like, and so in your timing and things like that, they wanted it in there. And so I think that's what was kind of sinful in that is because they didn't want God's king, they wanted their own king. And that's kind of what they got with Saul, right? Was they got the tall, pretty boy, right? And just like the other nations, right? Like, and that's kind of what he got. And so I think that's where the sinfulness. So there's always this expectation of a king, right? So I don't think it was their desire inherently for a king, because there was one, but it's for the right king, right? And stuff. So if that makes sense. Cool. Great question, though. All right, so then chapter 18, another aspect of the leadership is the priests. And so we have some laws concerning them. We've covered a lot with that, with Leviticus and everything as well. And then the other aspect of their leadership, so essentially Israel's leadership can be divided into three parts, where we have like the kings, the priests, and then the prophets. Those are really like the three main parts of their leadership. And so the last one here is we see laws concerning the prophets. And what I just want to point out here in chapter 18, verses 15 and 18. It says, I'll read verse 15. It says, the Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among you, from your brothers. It is to him you shall listen. And then skip a little verse 18. I will raise up for them a prophet like you from among their brothers, and I will put my words in his mouth, and he shall speak to them all that I command him. And so what you have in these verses is that one day there will be a prophet like Moses from among the people of Israel, and that they are to be on the lookout and to listen to and everything. And so while many prophets came after Moses, so if you look through the Old Testament, there's a lot that came, a lot of prophets after him. They were not actually like Moses, okay? And what we have is kind of most people, especially like in Jewish culture in that time, understood this as another reference to the Messiah. Okay, they understood a reference to Messiah. We see that kind of confirmed, if you remember in John chapter 1, when John the Baptist is on the scene and the people are questioning, like, who are you? They ask, are you the Christ? All that, right? But they also ask him, are you the prophet? They don't say, like, are you a prophet, right? They say, are you the prophet? And this is the passage they're referring to. Like, are you the guy? Are you the Deuteronomy 18 guy, the guy like Moses that we're supposed to be on the lookout for and to listen to him? And, of course, what does John say? He says, no, I'm not him, right? But then we see, what, who is that prophet? It's Christ, right? It's Jesus. Comes. He is that Messiah, okay? Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
And I mean, the passages of the New Testament are kind of indirect, right?
Yeah.
There's no one that says that he is the prophet.
Yeah. I mean, I'd argue even from this, right, of it says from among your brothers.
Muhammad was not countrymen.
Yeah. He was not from the people of Israel anymore at this point. So, yeah. But yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. But so it leaves with this idea of like, this is the guy like you need to be on the lookout for and you need to listen to him. And again, we'll kind of come back to that a little bit later as we wrap up Deuteronomy, but keep that in mind for now. All right. And then we have kind of laws concerning justice and society and war, all that. We have laws concerning purity, laws concerning interpersonal relationships, and laws concerning offerings of first fruits and tithes and all that. And then that takes us to, oops, I skipped one, chapter 27 and 28, which are famous for they are like the blessings and cursings of the law. Okay, so again, we've talked about where if you obey, there's blessing. If you disobey, there's curses. Okay, that's really the idea. And so, and upon entering the land, the people are actually supposed to they're supposed to recite all these blessings and curses as well. And so to remind themselves of this, this is the covenant they're part of. And so they are to be faithful to follow. Okay. And then chapters 29 and 30, we have kind of this renewing of the covenant. And so again, this new generation is about to enter the land. And so this is kind of a fitting renewal of this covenant. But some things to point out, just point out a couple things here that are significant for what we talked about before. In 29 verse 4, it's interesting that says, "But to this day the Lord has not given you a heart to understand, or eyes to see, or ears to hear." Okay, and so we see here that Israel is essentially has like spiritually darkened hearts, right? That they do not have hearts that understand. They have dull hearts. But if you remember before, what were they supposed to do with their heart?
Circumcise
it. Okay? But here it talks about that their hearts are kind of spiritually blind, and yet they're supposed to circumcise their hearts. Do you kind of see a problem with that? Like, how do you do that if you're kind of spiritually, like, darkened anyways? Huh? Yeah, you're getting to it, right? And so you see a problem. Like, how do you, if you're spiritually blind, how do you circumcise your heart? And the solution is given in chapter 30, okay? And chapter 30 talks again like their future as a nation and how a nation and how they're going to mess up. And so they're going to be sent into exile and all that. But the Lord will be faithful to bring them back. But not only will he bring them back, but then verse 6 of chapter 30, notice this verse. It says what? "And the Lord your God will do what? He will circumcise your heart and the heart of your offspring, so that you will love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul, that you may live." And so what's the solution? God will do it, right? Like, you need a circumcised heart, but your heart is messed up. You can't do it on your own. So what do you need? God to intervene. He will be the one to circumcise your heart. And so there's going to come a day where you go into exile, the Lord will do that, and he will circumcise your heart. And so when will this occur? It occurs as part of the what? The new covenant. Again, we see all these foreshadowings of this new covenant that's to come. And we see that's why Old Testament writers like Ezekiel pick up on this, where in Ezekiel chapter 36, he talks about how the Lord will do what? He will give you a new heart, right? He will give you a new heart as part of this new covenant. And so this passage here in Deuteronomy is just setting the stage for this new covenant that's to come. Okay, and we keep seeing these glimpses throughout the Old Testament of what's to come. Okay, so that's the important thing to keep in mind there. All right, and then we have kind of preparing for transition. So again, this is preparing this transition in leadership from Moses to Joshua. Again, Moses not entering the land. This is kind of his farewell kind of sermon here. And we have leadership being transferred to Joshua. But then you have the Song of Moses in these couple chapters. Moses' death is foretold. And then you have Moses give kind of a final blessing to Israel. But then the last thing we'll kind of wrap up here, chapter 34 is the actual death of Moses. And so in this chapter, you have this emphasis actually pointing to the future. Okay, so Deuteronomy wraps up with pointing and looking forward to the future. But you have in this chapter, the Lord brings Moses up onto the mountain to see the promised land. And he explains that, like, to Moses, this is the land he promised to Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. This is the land. And just like the patriarchs, Moses won't see the full fulfillment of that, at least not at this point, right? But one day, like, he will, right, with the millennium, all these different things, right? End time stuff. But notice these last couple verses, how this book kind of wraps up, verses 10 through 12. It says, "And there has not arisen a prophet since in Israel like Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face. None like him, for all the signs and the wonders that the Lord sent him to do in the land of Egypt, to Pharaoh and to all his servants and to all his land, and for all the mighty power and all the great deeds of terror that Moses did in the sight of Israel. And so notice how it ends, right? With this kind of final statement, like, and there is not arisen a prophet like Moses, right? And remember chapter 18, what? There is this guy who's going to come, right? And Deuteronomy ends like, he hasn't come yet, right? We're still looking forward, okay? He will be this one, okay? And why? Because he's going to be this one who comes and brings with him all these things we've seen, like the new covenant, all this stuff. And if you remember, like, where did Moses receive the law? Yeah, Mount Sinai on a mountain, okay? And part of that law was a lot of the blessings and curses, as we've seen. And if you remember, like, throughout Israel's history in the Old Testament, were they often under blessings or curses? Curses, right? They did not obey it very often, right? So there are often a lot of curses, and so that was kind of the emphasis. But then zoom ahead kind of many, many years, right, to the time of Christ. You do remember towards the beginning of his ministry, he had a sermon where? On the what? Mount, all right? And do you remember how he starts that sermon? Blessed, 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 right? And so what is that? He is the prophet like Moses, right? He has come to turn everything around, turning the cursing into blessing. This is the guy, right? And so Deuteronomy ends kind of pointing us in that direction, okay? Look out for this guy, right? This prophet who is like Moses, he hasn't come yet, like, look out for him. And then you have Christ coming in and essentially establishing and showing, like, I am that prophet. I am the prophet like Moses. I am here. Listen to my word, right? And so that's what we end looking forward to, okay? And so that kind of wraps us up. That leaves Israel on the plains of Moab. And so as we pick up the next class later on, we'll get into Joshua, where they actually get into the land and all that. All right.